Te presentamos a la familia Rubio. Ellos hacen todo en familia.
Rompecabezas, viajes a Walmart,
ejercicios, cocinamos,
todo.
Y cuando supieron que la farmacia de Walmart tiene vacunas para todas las edades, desde HPV hasta neumonía,
pues nos fuimos en familia a vacunarnos.
Y de una vez hicimos nuestras compras.
Like, obvio, Abu.
Protege a tu familia con vacunas para todos. Haz una cita hoy con los farmacéuticos expertos de Walmart Pharmacy. Bienvenido a una farmacia más simple. Bienvenido a tu Walmart. Sujetas a disponibilidad y ley estatal aplicable. Se aplican restricciones según la edad. Pregúntale a tu farmacéutico por detalles.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, normally a remedial course in baseball stats, but for this very special episode, a podcast about the Apple TV Plus show, Ted Lasso. I'm your host, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined by Alexander Chase and Richmond Till We Die co-host, Christian Dashiel. We will be talking about barbecue, Kansas City, the Royals, the Ted Lasso pod, mental health and sports, and, of course, Ted Lasso himself. Lots to unpack in this one, so without further ado, here is our conversation. Hey, Christian, thank you so much for being here with us. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm looking forward to this.
Alexander, how are things in D.C.?
No important weather to report. No important anything else to report. What other bases do I have to cover here? Yeah, no,
we have
pretty
to
well.
Loop Christian in on that joke. We have to. So inadvertently, we wound up starting almost every one of our pods for, I don't know, the first 20 episodes or so, just talking about weather, even when we weren't trying to. So now it's become the running joke. How's the weather? You're in Kansas, right?
Yeah, it switches every day. Like, we're in the first week of December right now, and it's going to be like 80 degrees here in 2 days. And then like 20 hours later, it's going to drop down into the 40s. So it's always a wild ride here.
Yeah, it actually sounds a lot like New England where I'm at. It's
in Texas.
It's different every day.
Oh, we're not special. I always thought we were special.
Yeah. I don't know about 80 to 40. I do have one picture from a couple of years ago where I took like a picture of the temperature outside in my car. It had like, you know, the thermometer, and it said, I don't know, it said like 62 degrees. And then the next day it was the same picture and it was like snow covered everywhere. That was a pretty interesting thing. Yeah. They say in New England, if you don't like the weather, just wait a day. But it's unseasonably warm around here. It's not like super hot, but anyway, I think we've met our weather quota for the episode. So what I want to do before we jump into anything, we have Christian here guesting from his podcast, which is called Richmond Till We Die, on Twitter at Ted Lasso Pod. Did I get all that right?
Yeah, perfect.
All right. Wow, that's great. I'm glad I got that on the first try. And we are going to talk about a ton of stuff. We're going to talk about how that came together. We're going to talk about some of the interviews you've been able to talk to cast members and all that. But we have to start with maybe the most important thing of all, which is your barbecue preferences in the area, your barbecue expertise. What makes different barbecue different in different places? We have to get this off the table right now, or else that's all I'm going to be thinking about the whole episode.
Well, then I guess I'll try to describe it unappetizingly then, so we don't think about barbecue. So just in terms of what makes different barbecue different, regionality, there are two things. Like, one is the temperature that barbecue is cooked at. In Texas, it tends to be cooked at a higher temperature, whereas in some of the other places, Kansas City style or Memphis style, Carolina style, that southern style, they go what's called like low and slow. And so you're talking like 325 degrees for the low side, and then in Texas, like, you know, they'll push up like, oh, I don't know, up into the 400s and do it much faster. Then the other thing that can differentiate barbecue is just the sauce, like the flavor profile. And so like Memphis style is known as being sweeter. Texas, they only use salt and pepper. If you're a true Texan, like that's all that you use. In Kansas City, you'll have kind of a sweet vinegary sauce. And then in the Carolinas, there are a couple different sauces, but they're generally known for being much more vinegary or mustardy. So, you know, it just kind of depends on, I guess, both the medium that you're using and then the process to differentiate your style.
So I, as someone who lived in Texas for 20 years, there's really only one style of barbecue, and that's Texas barbecue, and everything else is whatever.
Yeah.
I'm like 50% kidding, maybe, at most. Yeah, it's interesting for you to hear Texas barbecue described that way, because just for like closure or like full disclosure, there's this publication in Texas Monthly that every 4 years puts out their 50 best barbecue places in the world list, and they're all in Texas, naturally, and came out a couple months ago. And you know, it's kind of a big deal though, because like they talked about all the changes over the past few years, but Texas barbecue is the barbecue style they're importing into New York to like serve to places, and it's the thing that gets copied in a weird way whenever you want to do brisket. And take so much exception to the idea that you would cook brisket anything like above about 250 degrees. But I will say that you're not wrong. There are a lot of people who are cooking way too fast in Texas. That does exist.
Yeah. Well, and it kind of just depends. And I, you know, one of the things about barbecue now is as it's become more popular, there's been just tons of crossover.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And like fusion between the styles. Mm-hmm. And so you will have very few places that are like strictly a style. I cook my brisket and my beef ribs. I like to go about 285, and that is just kind of the temperature that, like, when Aaron Franklin talks about cooking his briskets, that he cooks his at. And so that tends to work for me, and not that I've been able to replicate his quality, but it's definitely like elevated my game trying to do what he says to do.
Yeah. And for those of you guys who aren't familiar with Aaron Franklin, obviously this is the part of the crossover that we're really hoping for on this pod. His Franklin's Barbecue in Austin is a place where you can wait in line for a really long time for barbecue that's worth the wait. I've only waited in that line once when I lived there, but and for anyone who is in the Texas anywhere, which is a huge state but still worth your while, he has like a crossover project with some other people in town called Loro. It's like a barbecue and then also like Japanese food combo, and it is just incredible. And also you can get Franklin's barbecue without the wait in the evening, and it is a great secret that if any of y'all are ever in Austin, I would strongly recommend. No free ads except this one, if you will.
So Christian, what's your favorite place? What's your barbecue mecca?
My first favorite, not because it's the best place necessarily, it's just where I fell in love with barbecue, is a little place called Roy's Barbecue outside of Hutchinson, Kansas. And I started going there when I was in college, and that was the first time, like, I grew up on the West Coast, mm-hmm. and so that was the first time like I had real barbecue. And it's this like standalone yellow building on the outside of this small town, and you go in and like you're just saturated with smoke for the rest of the day. Like, you have to take a shower after you leave there. And then in Kansas City, like, once we moved there, there are any number of places that I love, and I can like list the best thing for you to order on the menu at like six different places. But the place that has been like seminal for our family is Gates Barbecue. There was one of those, there are a number of different locations throughout the city, and it's like a historical place. Like, Ollie Gates is one of the fathers of Kansas City barbecue. But there was one in Kansas City, Kansas that was by our house. And so we went there a couple of times just on like really important days for our family. And so that is sort of baked into just kind of, I guess, our ethos now as a family.
So I want to ask a different question then. It's like, where do you want to go to try the barbecue most?
Oh, Austin, for sure. Like, we have had conversations in my house about like, sometime we just need to dip down to Austin for like a weekend. And I have my list of places that like we'll go to and check it out. So just from a concentration standpoint, like, you can hit so much. And I've already done Memphis. Like, I've spent time in Memphis and done six places there in a weekend. So yeah, Austin is another big one I just haven't been to yet.
I used to plan my vacations around where the craft beer was. So similar idea.
Well, yeah, we follow the meat.
Yeah. So we got the most important thing out of the way early. And talking about the meats. But I really do want to hear how the podcast got off the ground. If any of you have not checked this out, if you're a Ted Lasso fan of the show, you are doing yourself an enormous disservice by not checking out this podcast. Again, it's at Ted Lasso Pod on Twitter. You can find it in all the places you download and listen to your favorite podcasts. And the way that y'all got kind of go through these episodes is amazing in that, like, it's very spoiler free and very intellectual, and it reveals things that I certainly didn't see the first time. And I get to go back and re-enjoy those episodes for having listened to the way that you guys break that down. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I really want to know how this came together. Whose idea was it? How to get off the ground? All the good stuff. What's the origin story?
It was back in the very first days, weeks of 2021, and we just weren't doing a ton. Like, it was very winter COVID-y. Mm-hmm. And my friend Brett saw me tweet something about Ted Lasso, and he just hit me up, and he was like, "Hey man, do you want to do a Ted Lasso podcast?" And the thought had not even crossed my mind. I did a parenting podcast for like one season, and had invited Brett to be involved in that. And mm-hmm. then it just didn't work out with his schedule. So we'd worked together before and wanted to work together again. And so I was like, "Yeah, man, like, I have nothing else to do. So let's talk about a TV show on the internet." And then we spent a couple months like kind of planning it out and trying to figure out what we wanted the show to look like and be and do. And then we just kind of jumped in and, had a fun time hanging with each other.
Yeah. I mean, definitely you can tell that you all get along and get each other, have really great chemistry in the way that you put things together. And one of the things that you have managed to do, which is really, really impressive and enjoyable to listen to, is not just that you go through each episode, but you've been able to have interviews with cast members who you've connected with in various ways. So talk to us a little bit about some of those, and then hit us up with your favorite cast interview and let us know why that was your favorite.
The cast has been fun. They're super interactive. And I think that has to do with the show being a slow burn in terms of its popularity. Like, now, if you follow media and TV, it's ubiquitous. Like, mm-hmm. it's yeah. won all these Emmys and all these awards, but it really took a while for people to catch on to it. And so during those early months, the cast, I just think, was like so grateful and probably maybe like a little relieved that this thing that they thought was good, everybody else was thinking was good. That they've been like super interactive on the internet and willing as much as they have time to do interviews and interact with fans, which is cool. So, you know, like, we'll hit people up on Twitter, and if they can do it, they can do it. There have been some folks, we kind of have to like try to work through agents or publicists. It just sort of depends on the profile of the actor mm-hmm. and what's going on and how big the show is getting. For my favorite one, I really enjoyed the interviews that we did with two of the kids on the show, Elodie Blomfield, who plays Phoebe, mm-hmm. and then Kiki May, and she plays Nora. And I think the reason behind that is for each of them, those were their, like, we did their first interviews. And as a parent, like, I really wanted to do it because I thought we could do it well. But I also wanted it to be a really positive experience for the kids and their yeah. parents.
Yep.
And I do, like, I think we landed that. Like, I think when we finished and when those episodes are published, like, the kids had fun and the parents were like, "Okay, I'm glad that we trusted these people to do it." And I think, you know, we're giving fans of the show insight that they didn't have otherwise. And I think that maybe in surprising people with those interviews, insights in an experience that like they maybe didn't even know that they wanted or could get. So that part has been super fun.
Alexander, what's your favorite part of the show itself, the Ted Lasso show?
So Ted Lasso is like very different than most of the other TV I consume. And to be clear, I consumed the first season really quickly and then the second season really slowly, which is kind of a strange thing. But I tend to mostly watch TV about terrible people getting like what they deserve, if that makes sense. Like, I think the most important TV shows I've watched in the past year and change. I mean, I'm the sort of person who like gets just absolutely fired up to watch Succession and just all the mess that is. But I think like the most important TV show I've seen is The Good Place, like in the past couple of years. Like, I watched that every year because it came out. And then, like, you know, other things that kind of like sit in that sort of like instead of good things happening for good people, bad things happening to bad people. Like, that's my ideal kind of media. I want to cheer for real people and hate fake people. Like, that's the energy I want to spend. So, like, it's really weird to watch any part of Ted Lasso and want to cheer for any of the characters for me, because it's a fictional thing. And as a result, as I watched it, I had this weird sort of dread that, like, something awful is going to happen. And without spoiling much about the show, the way that it kind of subverts the expectations you have about who you're cheering for, what you're cheering for, who is actually good, and, like, what it means to improve or get worse as a person are kind of really great. So if I can say one particular thing without spoiling a whole lot, there's...
Warning.
No, really, actually, this isn't spoiling at all. I promise. So someone has a cameo in the second season who I recognized as, like, a comedic actor who was playing a very, like, profound, like, important role. And then, like, they have this great, like, switch flip towards the end that really, really satisfied me as a viewer. And I thought it was a sort of, like, great sort of, like, I feel like I know what's coming, but I know that I trust people who write this enough to, like, make me think about it. And, yeah, I know. I mean, I feel like feeling good while you're watching TV is kind of weird for me. And it's done a good job of making me feel good more often than I normally do. So, yeah.
You're definitely right. It was a slow burn to its popularity. I actually remember being so into it, and not a lot of other people had really watched it or maybe even heard of it. And I really wanted to, like, respond on Twitter to people with Ted Lasso GIFs, and they weren't anywhere to be found. And like you said, now they're everywhere. People using them all the time. So one of the things I really love about this show, and then we're actually going to switch gears a little bit, and then we're going to circle all the way back to the actual episodes. I'm a seventh grade teacher in my day job. And so one of the things that I teach social studies, one of the things I talk to my kids about all the time, I was doing it today, is that a lot of the media that we consume, we have superheroes and supervillains to one degree or another, whether it's MCU or whether it's, even something like a Sopranos, where, you know, he's a bad guy, but he's the good guy in this show, right? The anti-hero. It's, you know who you're rooting for, you know, good people do good things and bad people do bad things. And, you know, it's pretty easy. And when you look at your own life through that lens, it can make you feel all sorts of ways. And when I'm trying to teach, you know, 12 and 13 year olds about the world, one of the things that is hard sometimes, I think, for them to grasp and understand is the complexity of humanity, and that bad people can do and are capable of doing good, whatever the motivations, and good people are capable of making mistakes and doing bad things. And I think this show is really excellent as it plays out at showing that complexity of people who in another show would just be the heel, and that's all they would be, and the hero, and showing that there are different sides to that. I don't know. It's one of the things that I really enjoy very much about the show. And we are going to get back to talking more about actual Ted Lasso, but I got one more thing I want to talk to you about, Christian, before we take a small break and then circle back to really diving into some of the content. And that is that you were a Kansas City Royals season ticket holder, and I want to know more about that.
Yeah, it was fun, even though they were during years that the Royals were really bad. Like, it was probably, I don't know, like 2008 through 2011. And so, you know, for the most part, like, the stadium wasn't very full and the Royals didn't win a lot of games. But there's something about baseball that is conducive to a social experience where you, like, connect with other people through conversation while the game is going on, that you can't have really well when you go to watch other sports. And so, you know, we had a lot of fun memories of going to afternoon games, and, like, our oldest son, he's in sixth grade now, but, like, he went to his first Royals game when he was 18 days old because we had tickets, and, like, we're, like, kind of getting cabin fever or whatever, because had just been in the house, and yep, we knew that we could go for six innings if we wanted and then leave. And so just have a lot of memories in that park and of players. And then it was obviously fun for, you know, 4 years when they were really good and really good in surprising ways and mm-hmm. kind of like became America's team for the time when they were kind of upsetting people, I guess, and being the little engine that could.
Alexander, what are your memories of the Kansas City Royals from that time?
So as a youth or whatever, I feel like the Royals World Series runs were some of the ones that I got to like enjoy with people in a much more public way than like any of the other ones. That was like when I was like living in the dorms in college. It's like watching the Royals win, which is really cool, actually. You know, because when else do you get to like just yell at everyone else for being like, I don't know, like Red Sox fans, I guess, right? Yeah,
right. Hey,
I know exactly what I'm doing. So like, I have some fun memories there. It's been nice in the years since, you know, new owner John Sherman is definitely a person like I kind of trust more than about 25, at least, of the other owners to like try to do a good job. Just kind of nice. So, you know, it's been fun to kind of casually root for the Royals to be above average. And, you know, it's not like Kansas City is a place where you can't win like sports things. Like, Chiefs are good at football, draw a bajillion people. Do you know how much money gets pumped into Kansas basketball every year? Like, there's no reason why you can't try to be good at baseball in Kansas City. It's a pretty big city. So, I'm really hoping that, you know, as things shake out with the new CBA, there are some interesting I really hope they happen. Suggestions about shrinking down to just four divisions, you know, two and two, which would mean that the Royals would no longer be competing with, you know, the AL Central's lack of spending and would have to try probably a little bit harder than they currently are. But they've been tracking towards trying for trying's sake. And, you know, if there's one fandom that I'm happy that we can have two consecutive Royals fans, I guess, in back-to-back weeks, that's definitely one of the teams I'm happy to have it. So, yeah, good for y'all. That is absolutely a fandom that I have no problem for. And, I mean, like, it's fun to root against the Red Sox, not just because, you know, Matt, but, you know, because that's how things work.
Fine. I can handle it.
But, yeah, that's the other thing.
Well, here's,
you know, it's only people who can't handle it because there's just, like, nothing redeemable that makes it unfun.
Kind of an intersection between what we were talking about earlier with Ted Lasso and character arc is, like, the word for, you know, people changing and they're not being good guys and bad guys. Like, that happened with the Royals. You know, their owner essentially, like, bought the team from a beloved owner who passed away on the cheap, and there are serious questions as to whether or not he wanted to win for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he was just going to kind of milk it for what it was worth and then let it go. And then there did come a point where a switch flipped for him. And when they started trying and spending some more money and being strategic, and they did have to find ways to smartly spend more money in ways that other teams weren't, but then winning did become important to him. And when he sold the team to John Sherman, you know, David Glass had cancer and kind of knew that he was in, you know, his last days, years. And just in terms of building legacy and doing right by the city, he approached John Sherman saying, like, I know that you love this city. Like, you are a Kansas Cityan. You are a proven businessman. I want you to buy this team. And I know that you love baseball because John Sherman was part of the Cleveland Indians ownership group at that time. And so going from being someone, an owner that fans protested and hated and felt like, you know, they were really, their experience was getting cheated and that he didn't even care about Kansas City, for him to then deliver those memories and a championship and then to really hand the team off in an intentional way to someone who would do well by the city is an incredible arc that someday, like, there should probably be a movie about.
Well, I was going to ask you one more question, but I think that that's a pretty sweet way to end that segment. And I know that we are all very excited to get into talking about, like, the life lessons of Ted Lasso and how that is universally applicable to all sports, including baseball. But before we get to that, we are going to take a small break and we will be right back.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball, even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
And we're back. So now is the opportunity, Christian, where we can really start to dive into sort of those lessons, those takeaways. It seems as though something that's very important to the three of you, on your pod, is kind of talking about mental health in general, and you know, how people kind of see themselves and the lessons for men and white men to kind of take from the show about maybe better ways of being, and all of these things that are working in a show at a time where people are incredibly divided and constantly fighting, and there's a lot of toxicity and the lessons that this provides for us. So I guess we could start with something pretty broad and just say, like, what do you think are the broad strokes of this show? We've touched on a couple of them, but if you had to, like, attach a theme to this show, what would you maybe say that is?
It's a show about vulnerability. It continues to ask the question of who are you going to let in and who are you going to take a risk to love? And there are times where that plays out in sporting terms, you know, mm-hmm. how bad it hurts when your team gets close and doesn't win, and just how people can live and breathe with that community experience, right, of rooting for a team together, but then also in relationships. And so you said earlier that there are a lot of subversive things that happen in Ted Lasso, and some of those subversive things are, you know, like men being vulnerable with each other, mm-hmm. or subverting, you know, the masculine and feminine characteristics that we expect in romantic relationships. And so it just, like, through these first two seasons, that is the question that it continues to ask, is what does it mean for us, I guess, to, like, risk things with each other, maybe, like, to be brave enough to do that and to trust each other enough and to be trustworthy enough, where we can be risky with each other in healthy, growth-oriented ways.
Yeah, definitely. To that point, I'm going to ask you, and again, we're going to try and stay spoiler-free here. I know that's something that you try really hard on your podcast to do, which is actually very impressive for a podcast dedicated entirely to a show to not be filled with spoilers is remarkable. What would you say if you were to take the character of just Ted, the main character in the show, his best qualities and his worst qualities, and why? Because I have a feeling, and listen, I'm not trying to paint you in a corner here. You can answer this however you want. But I have a feeling that maybe some of what we're looking at as worst qualities, there's some layers to that. So what do you think are his best and worst qualities, and why?
The best quality is not quitting on people. He does have a deep sense of belief in people's capacity to change and to improve. He's just very, I guess, hopeful in people and trying to see the best in them. And that is something that, you know, in this world that we are living in right now, that is just really difficult to do and that we need a lot more of. Mm-hmm. The thing about Ted's worst qualities is in season two, we start to learn why people are the way they are.
Right.
I guess that maybe starts in, you know, the last couple episodes of season one with some characters that are, like, just act in unconscionable ways. And then you kind of, like, start to get some pieces together, and that doesn't, you know, excuse their behavior, but it at least helps you see where they're coming from, like what their hurts are, what their brokenness is, the roots of their dysfunction. And so, you know, for Ted, we do see him in his rosiness, sometimes like sacrificing things that could be good for other people because he's so focused on personal development. It's like, you know, you still have a job and right, there are still people that you are accountable to on a sporting level. And he doesn't always do the best by them in some situations because he's trying to develop people. And there are, I guess just times, especially in the second season, where then he even loses himself a bit. And there are reasons, but if he would, his journey of like opening up and being vulnerable and trusting and doing all of those things, you just kind of start to see that he has some work to do there. And so for him to be the best version of himself, he's going to need to do some of the things that he is trying to get other people to do.
So one of the things I feel is like kind of interested in those are words, things that I think are kind of interesting about like watching and thinking about how people change in Ted Lasso and a lot of other TV, because I don't think you can watch TV these days without watching everything else, right? You watch Ted Lasso with all the expectations that all the other shows you've watched over the past 10 years put on you. It is how kind of free almost everybody on the cast is from like the way that like working and money like distorts your mind and destroys your mind. Because like it's really easy to imagine. It's like I know how much money a team loses because they get less good results in the Premier League, let me put it that way, and to think then that like someone who is an owner and has just unfathomable amounts of money would just willingly leave money on the table is not something that characters in a lot of shows would like let happen to them. The idea that players would lose money, that any of these people would make choices that would sacrifice their own bottom line, it's not something a lot of shows explore, and I don't think that Ted Lasso largely explores, though. I'm very interested to see how Rebecca's husband kind of fares in the long run, because he definitely seems like the person they're writing to kind of do those sorts of things. So, like, I feel like a lot of other money or a lot of other shows tread that ground in some really well-trodden ways. And I don't know, do you find it refreshing to find that that's not a topic of conversation as often as it could be?
Yeah, one of the segments that we have on our show is, you know, like, what was the like most real life soccer thing in this episode and what was like the least real life soccer thing, because there's so many people that watch the show that aren't soccer fans. And there are a number of times where it kind of comes back to like, this decision would not be made because it just like doesn't make financial sense and people in this world don't do that. And so as a show, we try to acknowledge those things and we do try to point them out, and like we try not to be the super like condescending soccer fans to people, but we do just try to like at least acknowledge it and say, yeah, this isn't how it would go, we understand why, and now like we're gonna move on. So yes, you're right, the money thing often doesn't ring true to life and allows the characters to do things they otherwise wouldn't do in the real world.
Do you think that some of that is, like you said, there's non-soccer fans watching, and so they really want to just show like this is really driven by a desire for vengeance, and I'm at all costs. So it might not be soccer realistic, but it's necessary as a device for helping non-soccer people understand like the depths of the feeling that is going on, or is it just maybe an oversight?
No, I think it's intentional. With storytelling, you have to make sacrifices. And this is not a sports show. This is a show that uses sports as a vehicle to talk about life and about people. And there's just not a lot about this show, I think, that is happenstance. Like, so much of it is intentional. And, you know, while that piece often doesn't ring real, I think they also deserve a lot of credit for the attention to detail that they pay to soccer absolutely. stuff. And as a soccer fan, there are a lot of times where I'm like, man, that's really good. Like that, that really is impressive that they were able to do that, or that really does ring true.
Yeah. Watching Coach Beard read Inverting the Pyramid episode in and episode out is really accurate, because that's on my wish list actually for Christmas, if someone in particular is listening to this.
Okay, fine, fine.
But yeah, like I find that a lot of like the idea of cheering for the owner of a sports team is so antithetical to a lot of the things that I end up talking about so often, and it's kind of funny. Here I was like, what, like not even 15 minutes ago talking about how I'm soft rooting for the Royals because their owner is less bad. But you know, the realities of it is that, like, a lot of sports programming we consume, it kind of exists on the sort of like kid level, where you're no like where like your protagonists are kids in some sort of way, and they can be detached from these realities, you know. So much children's content makes the smart choice to suspend disbelief, to let people make character choices rather than be like, nope, they would just go to jail, or the bad guys would just be competent and they would stop you because you weigh 80 pounds. And I think there's a lot of that actually, that like, you know, if you compare Ted Lasso to so much of like the kind of nostalgic sports content, it knows what world it's existing in when it ignores those realities or lets them play in some different ways. I like it because I can just go consume all of the bad guys evil show on HBO after the fact later on. And I think that's fine. But, you know, it's kind of hard at the other time to think like so many of the things that like contribute to what we actually talk about as mental health for like people who don't make soccer player salaries do come from like not having money and having to work an obscene right. amount of hours and stuff like that. So it's interesting to kind of like be really critical and like put on my being upset cap and then just thankfully take it right off, because like I'm a human person who can just like not for a second and like enjoy things. Because, you know, there are lots of discussions that can be had about all sorts of different content, right? And we don't all need to collapse into each other. Ted Lasso can work differently than White Lotus, and I can enjoy that and learn things from it and like think about how much being a Tottenham Hotspur fan hurts me instead of how much, you know, my job hurts me.
And it is, I mean, it's honest about what it is.
Yeah.
The premise of the show is that a Division II like college football coach at a school that doesn't have football in Wichita goes and coaches a Premier League team. Like from the jump, there's a giant clue there that like, we are not, this is not a documentary.
Right.
Like, we are going to have to really like suspend some things. And I guess probably part of the credit of the show is there are aspects of the sporting world that it exists in that are so convincing that sometimes we forget from the start, the whole thing's like preposterous.
Yeah. Right. That's a good word. I'll show you what I know about soccer. When he's reading Inverting the Pyramid, I thought that was more symbolic of like, see Ted putting himself at the bottom and everybody else in front of him and trying to lead from behind and all of those things. And then Alexander was just like, no, that's a real thing. And it's a book and it's this and that. And so there you go. But the fact that I can be so sucked into a show and that's that I have very little knowledge of soccer, I think is a credit to, as you said before, it's not a show about soccer. It's a show about people and relationships. It actually reminds me in that way, and it's a very different show, but there's a through line with Bill Lawrence and Scrubs, in that a lot of people who work in hospitals have actually said it's one of the more accurate shows for the medicine, but it's not a show about doctors. It's a show about relationships and how people connect and disconnect and love and hate and are frustrated and, you know, craving attention from a father figure and, you know, all of those really life lesson things that could have been said anywhere. So I think that's, it really does speak to the character and the heart of the show that somebody like me who had no idea what that book was all about, or the relevance of it and the idea of like Beard reading it on the plane while Ted is going to, you know, sleep it off.
Take a nap.
Yeah, right. There's just so many levels there. I think that you can appreciate this show in so many ways. And if you don't happen to know what you need to know to appreciate it on one level, you can get it on six others. It's just so well put together.
It's what makes it a great show to like do a podcast about, because there's always something that is fun for us as hosts to learn when we have questions and we like make a note of something. And then, you know, there's always something for us to like bring to the table to hopefully, I don't know, just like be a tool to help people enjoy the show, I guess, on a different level or a little bit more, however like you want to say it. But just, I guess, to maybe make the next time they watch it a different experience from the last time they watched it.
So I have like a two on topic question for myself, and I'm okay with how this is going to play out. How much like Premier League soccer do you watch regularly?
All of it is all of it.
Yeah, okay, that's a good answer. Like, yeah,
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Which team do you watch most often / call your own / get angry at the most? All the same question, really.
Norwich. Yeah. Norwich Canaries.
That is a really good answer. I won a Norwich kit, actually. They're green and yellow is beautiful.
Canaries.
So like, I feel like then if you're in that position, like the sort of like rebounding back and forth for everything has to be really interesting. How do you kind of like compare that to like how you have experienced like sports fandom for like American sports, where like the whole promotion, relegation, and like everything else is so much different?
Yeah, you know, being a Royals fan is similar, I guess, to being a Norwich fan. You don't go up and down between leagues in, well, any American sport, I guess, but in baseball. But there are times where you feel like you are part of the bigger competition, and there are times where you don't, because in baseball, you can have developmental times where you're paying a little bit more attention to the minor leagues, and because you just like don't have a chance at the playoffs or whatever. So I guess that is similar. You know, to me, the thing that soccer is most like on the international stage is really college football in the US. Like, to me, that is the closest analog, just in terms of the way people find identity in it. Mm-hmm. And so you can actually, in a lot of ways, like kind of be okay with where you're at and who you are. And so, you know, you see that with like Division II schools and Division III schools, and even sometimes like in smaller conferences that may not have teams that can compete for the national championship, like I think they want to and they dream about it, and maybe there's going to be this fairy tale like in the English Premier League Leicester City was a couple of years ago. But there are also like great things in qualifying for like the best bowl game you can and doing right. well there and maybe like upsetting somebody. So, you know, to me, like, that is one of the reasons that I love soccer. Is not like the competition is cool, but then also knowing that there is something beneath that that's full of meaning that doesn't exist in most other sports is also part of like why I just enjoy being part of that world.
When I was 16, I went to Germany to stay with a student who had stayed with me, and we did a little, you know, back and forth. And one of the things that we did was go to a soccer match. And as a sports fan my whole life, I was very ill prepared for what that meant. And, you know, I know that the German League and Premier League are different. That's big for me. But the intensity as we were walking through, we were in Hamburg and we were watching them play Bayern Munich. And as we were walking through, you know, the kid said, like, just don't make eye contact if you can help it, because you don't want to make eye contact with the wrong person. And that's not to say soccer fans are bad people, but I think it does speak to the intensity of the fandoms, to the point where people care so intensely about their teams. And it is such a part of who they are that, you know, you get that sort of stuff. And it was one of the greatest experiences that I've had, and nothing like it here. I mean, I've been to Red Sox Yankees games, and you know, I was outside of Fenway Park for a World Series game in 2004, and those are intense moments. But I don't know. I still don't think I've experienced anything like that game in 1996.
And there's upsides and downsides. The upside, like the best case scenario with soccer, is that you have a team like Norwich, really, where people have this just really like intense belief and pride in their community in overall like a healthy way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what you don't get in a lot of American sports, like, you don't go to a baseball game and think, oh man, like, you know, I might encounter a lot more Nazis here than I usually do. And like, you know, like white supremacy and racism, like there are things in the soccer world, like some pretty toxic supporter cultures, and some, like, not all, and it's not going to be everybody in the stadium, but there's some darkness there,
sure,
that also comes out with the intensity. It's not all,
there's a movie called Green Street Hooligans that was actually, I think, again, from a non-soccer point of view, it brought me in and sucked me in. I thought it was kind of a deep dive into some of that subculture. Very interesting movie if you've seen that.
It's a kind of a seminal movie for folks that are in that world.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like I often say that, like, sports is kind of like reality, a funhouse mirror, and soccer is way more that way than baseball is, because there's just so much more variety. But also, I think in part because, like, the way that we've seen sort of like shifting sands in the soccer world over the past decade, two decades, has been so much more pronounced than in baseball, where, like, things have actually settled in some very weird ways. You know, it's like, it's weird that we've been so complacent with, like, you know, like, I imagine, like, Hamburg fans would be willing to set Chase Field on fire if their team did anything resembling to what the Diamondbacks have done recently. Like, the sort of, like, let's all just do, like, the profit-maximizing fan less good sorts of things that, like, you know, you just gotta call it for what it is. Like, teams are willing to tank and then just not be good on the other side of tanking, and then just tank again and in some really awful ways in baseball, which are just completely, completely unforgivable sins that will have, I say that Chase Field would be burned down really confidently, because I don't think that anything anywhere close to that is within the pale. The sort of things we've seen recently with, like, a European Super League getting shut down almost immediately by fans, you know, and the difference is really important. You know, it's like a lot of clubs, you brought up Germany, like the Bundesliga has a rule which, like, two clubs have broken kind of loosely about, like, fans owning more than half the team. And, you know, throughout the rest of, you know, Europe, there are a lot of teams that are owned actually by American owners. The club I support, Tottenham Hotspur, the club that, by the way, Ted Lasso sort of, kind of, but doesn't, but does coach in, like, this original sketch came out 7 years ago.
Version 1.0.
Is owned by an American, Joe Lewis. The thing is, like, there are supporter trusts. And I think the reason that a lot of Americans, I think, do gravitate to soccer, the reason that I gravitated to soccer, is just because there is that passion. I kind of got the ick for college football because of concussions and because, like, my fellow college classmates weren't being paid while, like, super, super rich coaches got huge buyouts to get fired, basically. It's really, really awful in this sort of, like, as soon as you put the magnifying glass to it, it just melts. And that's the appeal, is that you do feel like there's something so much more, like, egalitarian about fandom. And as we sit here in this lockout, which is brought on by ownership not wanting to pay the players more in a lot of different ways, and you can't escape it, you know? So, you know, there's a lot to watch, both Ted Lasso and everything else. And I do hope that, you know, people give it a shot, because, you know, I think, like, I watch sports for different reasons. Like, I watch baseball because I think it's a compelling game in some ways, but I watch soccer much more from the human aspects. And it's interesting to kind of see how those things cross over, and, like, why we choose to watch what we watch.
Yeah.
Now, Christian, you are a man of many talents, as we talked about with barbecue before. You have some training that comes up on the show, and you take some perspectives. You guys talk a lot about Shakespeare, which goes over my head because I never understood it. But one of the things that you talk about a lot is kind of this extra character that's not a character but is intensely purposeful, and that is the music that exists within the episodes. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about the role that music plays, and if you can think off the top of your head of any of examples. This is something that can be fairly spoiler free pretty easy, so feel free to talk about anything that really sticks in your mind about the use of music.
In the interest of full disclosure, Brett and Marissa are music people.
Right.
I am a decidedly, like, third chair. They are professional musicians and have, like, actually, like, they have degrees in music, so I bring some things to the table, but they bring most of them. And I just, like, the one thing I brought to the table is Brett did not know that Sweet Georgia Brown was the theme song for the Globetrotters, and I was very impressed with myself that I knew a music thing he didn't.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, you have two roles that music plays, or two types of music, I guess. One is the scoring. So that's like the original music that is composed by Marcus Mumford and Tom Howe. And one of the cool things about that is they pay so much detail to the show, so much attention to detail, that there are some characters that actually have their own themes. And so as a Star Wars fan, this is something mm-hmm. I started to notice like earlier on in life than most kids, that like, oh, Luke and Leia have a theme. When something is happening with them, you are going to hear some version of this sound. Obviously, like the Darth Vader one is the most famous and obvious right. and just kind of like smacks you in the face, but there are a lot of others. And so they do have themes in Ted Lasso for different characters if those characters are experiencing something. And then the other type of music is like what they bring in for the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty diverse. Like there's Jason Sudeikis is a big 90s hip hop fan. So you get some of those references, and we've gotten some Rolling Stones. The thing about being an Apple show is they have so much money, like they can pay for the rights for anything. Mm-hmm. So they have access to a lot of things other shows don't have, which gives them a lot of opportunities to make statements with the music and embed things that other shows can't.
Now, we're not spoiling anything about TV, and I avoided talking about some other TV shows. Are we allowed to spoil Star Wars?
I think that's safe.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think the shelf life is up.
Yeah, because we're going to talk about Leitmotif, you know, and all that good stuff. You know, it's crazy how much you can, if you really want to be crazy about that, dig into what those themes and how they're written say things about characters. And I haven't thought about that for a single TV show other than like Avatar The Last Airbender in my life. So right. I feel like I owe y'all some more. And I've dug into a good amount of the first season because I really want to know what y'all felt about Nate. Because, you know, he's can I say that he's being turned into Jose Mourinho? Is that allowed? Can I say that on here?
You can, it's okay, your show. Well, you can do whatever you want. Well, yes.
And he shows it very early. Let me say it that way. Like that in the first season, they are turning him into Jose Mourinho very quickly. I want to know if there is anything in his potential leitmotif that it spoils that in the same way that the Rey leitmotif in Star Wars spoils that she is a Palpatine, which it does, actually. It's just really weird. And I don't know how the way they give it
away. I don't know. Like, I guess it's always tough when you get partway through a story to know. Like, that stuff is easier when you look back on it. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, with the Rey stuff, you know, I was rooting for her to be a Kenobi, and I thought that people had made some pretty compelling arguments that like she could be headed that way, and I thought that would have been really cool. So, you know, the one thing I hold to with Ted Lasso is that it is really focused on people changing, and for most of the characters we encountered them at like their bottom or least desirable, and then got to experience like the fuzzies of their warm swing or their upswing. And so, you know, like the story's not over yet for right. him. And there could very well be like an upswing for him. And I don't know, maybe not, but like even Darth Vader threw Palpatine down a shaft. So like he could still do some things.
I mean, I think we have to be fair to Nate. It's been a come up for him. It's his hero origin story. We just may not be seeing it that way all the time.
The Nate thing is interesting to me, and I try not to be too judgy about people, but I'm like, man, like y'all need to chill out. Like, you know, I think they did try to leave some like breadcrumbs, and they tried to build some empathy for him along the way in season two, not to excuse his behavior, but to at least help you understand how he got there. And I think there are a lot of folks that maybe aren't leaving enough room for forgiveness to grow in season three, and maybe like they'll get there, but well, people are really
I'm looking for
bad.
Some more bottom to bottom out into personally for everyone, actually. I think that's like where I have to go mask off on this. Is like I am actively cheering for at least one or two people on average to bottom out harder in this third season, because I just think they always need to up the stakes in every season of every show. And the way that they treat that in Ted Lasso is, I think, way more interesting than it has been for any other show I've watched. So I want to watch them write it. I want to watch that cast make it happen. And I want to watch people like you and myself and whoever else freak out about it, because it's been fun. Fundamentally, it's so much different for me than watching just like a pure hate watch. You know, like I watch a lot of like Real Housewives. I watch a lot of reality TV and I watch a lot of just like HBO. These are terrible people shows. And it's so much more fun sometimes to be wrong and have to cheer for
someone. They have the same decisions to make that needed to be made and negotiated after Empire Strikes Back. Like, there are early versions of that script where Han Solo dies in Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. And George Lucas chose not to go that way. He chose to go a different way. And that
bothered Harrison Ford, didn't it?
It bothered Harrison Ford. It, like, Irvin Kershner, like, left the project. And a lot of people, like, attribute his fingerprints to making Empire Strikes Back, like, one of the best movies ever. And people look at, you know, what Return of the Jedi ended up being and saying, like, that's because Irv left, you know? So there are decisions to be made. Like, what direction do you want to go with that? And when the thing is landed, if we really do like land it after three seasons, I don't know, I guess, like, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to give people like a realistic full experience? Are you trying to give people uplift after a really difficult second season? And there's a lot on the table there that I'm not privy to any of those conversations.
It's hard to have every single person in a situation land on their feet and handle things with grace and dignity. You know, I one of the things I do like about it, beating up on poor Nate here, but his story arc is still consistent with the show and the themes of the show. His reactions may not be what we want, and he might not be at that last moment at the end of the second season. You know, a lot of people just kind of, right in their heads. But it's very consistent, and they lay it out very well in season two, like the place that all of that is coming from. And, you know, the father figure is omnipresent in this show. In lots of ways. And I think that's a very relatable. And you know, look, you can look around to a lot of different grown men and you can trace a lot of good and bad back to their relationships with their dads. And so is it an excuse? Absolutely not. But it does, as you said, kind of it works by way of explanation. And there's room for compassion in there because, you know, when a character is on a show, it's funny, we're talking about characters like they're real people, but we're seeing every element of them, right? Nobody's following us around with a camera to show our worst moments or our worst decisions or our meltdowns or our breakdowns. And if they did, I think we would all come off looking much worse than we are as people. So I think you're right in that there's a lot of space and room, and I hope that they explore that in a meaningful way, even if it's not, you know, a Disney ending. You know, I don't think it needs to be for it to still be meaningful.
One of the things that we said between seasons was, you know, everything wrapped up relationship wise pretty dang tidy after season one, that either they were going to have to introduce a diabolical character to hurt people, and it was going to be hard to see how you could do that. And after we had gotten to like know this core group of people and have it be convincing, or a character that we had grown to love was going to have to hurt another character that we had grown to love.
Right.
And that is the choice that they made. And like that hurt a lot of fans, but it was convincing. Like,
sure.
People are really,
people wouldn't be up in arms if they weren't sucked in and attached and kind of in love with the show. Right. It wouldn't, nobody would care. All right, I want to go to one last segment before we come to the end of our episode, which seems like this has flown by, and that is stealing the segment you mentioned earlier from your show and recreating it here and talking a little bit more about what you think are the most realistic and least realistic soccer things that have happened across the show. I know, again, we're trying to be as spoiler-free as possible. We did talk a little bit about, you know, owners just being willing to take huge financial losses being pretty unrealistic. But you did hint at some things that were pretty realistic. So, you know, just a few of those, and we'll give Alexander an opportunity to talk. And that way, if he spoils something, it's on him and not on you.
I was really impressed. I'm always impressed with how real and fleshed out the crowds feel. And part of that is, it's amazing. They've done quite a bit of CGI to fill out those crowds. And even as somebody who watches a lot of soccer, as I've gone through and watched season two now, like 2 and 3 times, really trying to find the places where I can tell it's CGI and I can't. So they did just a really wonderful, lovely job of capturing that as best they could. And I love the depth that that gives the few soccer parts of the show that we have. It's really fun for me as a soccer fan.
Alexander, how do you feel about the soccerness of the soccer show?
So I really want to give like some more specific like Tottenham related bits here, because it's really important actually to like the show's DNA is kind of like that Tottenham connection. So Brett Goldstein, who is Roy Kent, his family are Tottenham fans. They've talked a little about, I know he wrote an episode in season two where Tottenham plays an important part. And I want to say the realism brought in by his familial experiences are so accurate. Them bottling a game and losing when it matters is just so authentic, and it really made me feel like it was at home. The unrealistic part here is where who is the former Arsenal player that he forces to like have a line where he says Tottenham is a top team?
Thierry Henry.
Yes, he makes Thierry Henry compliment Tottenham. And I don't, honestly, that's
right.
It's the fact that I found that like out of place that makes this show's topic worth exploring. Like, you know, it's the sort of thing where, you know, we can imagine, you know, like, I don't know, you get David Ortiz or, you know, I don't know, any other number of like Red Sox legends to go up and say like nice things about the Yankees on a broadcast. And it's like, it happens actually a little bit more often than you'd think. Whereas like, it's like really unexpected when some of like the English pundits who are really set in their ways are even mildly complimentary to someone on the opposition side. It's really funny actually. So yeah, I mean, like, we take for granted so much of like our commentary and like consumption as being like mildly, I don't know, like unbiased. I mean, like, obviously most people are, but they're just not very good at it. Whereas like, it's the commitment to the bit, unlike the British soccer coverage of just being like, nope, I will never say a nice thing about Liverpool ever. And you know, Thierry Henry saying nice things about Tottenham, it could never happen without him being paid.
There is something very comforting in real soccer about the voices that they use.
Arlo White, yeah.
Like having Jeff Stelling and Arlo White, like, you know, it is really cool that they have brought in those broadcasters, and as someone who watches a lot of soccer, like, just helps it feel very real. And it's fun that Arlo White has embraced the show to the point where he even like slipped in a Ted Lasso reference during the Crystal Palace Everton match this weekend, and he's kind of like embraced it and feeds it and gives winks and nods all the time to the fans.
I mean, I think the thing that the show can rely on, which is really nice, is the fact that the people who are involved with broadcasting and promoting the game, other than like actual FIFA and UEFA, love it and want it to be successful. Yeah. And all shade intended. Like the people who broadcast, the people who like promote it online are all kind of aligned in that. Like, people are exciting. The sport's fun to watch. It is a fantastic thing to be a fan of. Whereas there's not consistently that same thing in baseball. And it's really important, I think, for people who are like in Matt and I's position, who talk about it all the time, to like call out the nonsense where people are saying things that are dumb. You know, it's like nobody's, you know, saying that Brighton or like Brentford, like, capitalizing on set pieces is a bad thing. Like, nobody's doing that. Everyone's just like, yeah, it's really fun that people who are winning and that's it. And I wish we could steal more of that. So that's actually another bit of realism that I want to say, is that you know, the positivity in the show towards the sport itself is really refreshing. So if that's a place I can end on, Tottenham, Till they kill me, as they say. Not Richmond till I die, Tottenham till they kill me. oh boy.
All right, Christian, that's it really does bring us to the end. I just want to give you the opportunity to, if there's anything that you kind of have bouncing around in your head left unsaid, to go ahead and say it.
No, I've said it all.
Yeah.
Just, right. I do encourage people. I encourage people to go, and if you haven't watched the show, give it a run and just see what you think. And I think it can kind of take a few episodes to get your footing, but the nice thing is with at least in the first season, a show that, you know, caps out at between 25 and 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have a huge investment of time to feel as though whether or not like you're into what's going on.
Absolutely. Before we let you go, could you just remind people who are listening where they can find you and your pod and your co-hosts and all of that?
Yeah, we are at www.tedlassopod.com. And then if you just search in whatever your podcast app is, Richmond Till We Die, you can find us. We have a logo that looks like a soccer crest with a greyhound on it. You can find us at Ted Lasso Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And I am at Dash the Tweeter on Twitter as well. So there you can find some of my other projects and stuff that I write.
Fantastic.
And whatever I'm ranting about that day.
And your co-hosts?
Marissa is not online, so you'll just have to tune into the podcast to listen to her.
Yeah.
And you can find Brett, and I actually don't remember what his Twitter handle is right now.
That's
but
okay. Maybe he doesn't
Collins,
want us to tell people. We probably should have checked, huh?
Yeah, we probably should have asked him about that. So you can find him if you want to, and he's a nice guy, so he'll say hi.
Yeah, all right. Well, Alexander, once again, we've come to the end of an episode. We know where we can find Richmond Till We Die. Can you let the people know where they can find us?
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.